going to marry Griselda. Life and death went on. Children were born and old people died. On Sunday, Emma Butchers attacked her adulterous husband Edward with his largest cleaver in a fit of jealous rage. On Monday, one of Bess Hampton's chickens went missing, and was found boiling in a pot over Glinny Thompson's kitchen fire, whereupon Glinny was stripped and flogged by John Constable. On Tuesday, Howell Tyler was working on the roof of St. Mark's Church, when a rotten beam gave way beneath him and he fell, crashing through the ceiling to the floor below, and died immediately. By Wednesday the wreckage of the bridge had been cleared, all but the stumps of two of the main piers, and the timber was stacked on the bank. The waterway was open, and barges and rafts were able to leave Kingsbridge for Malcolm with wool and other goods from the fleece fair consigned to Flanders and Italy. When Carris and Edmund went to the riverside to check on progress, Merthyn was using the salvaged timbers to build a raft to ferry people across the river. "It's better than a boat," he explained. "Livestock can walk on and off, and carts can be driven on too." Edmund nodded gloomily. "It will have to do for the weekly market. Fortunately, we should have a new bridge by the time of the next fleece fair."
"I don't think so," Merthyn said.
"But you told me it would take a year to build a new bridge."
"A wooden bridge, yes. But if we build another wooden one, it, too, will fall down."
"Why?"
"Let me show you."
Merthyn took them to a pile of timber. He pointed to a group of mighty posts. "These formed the piers. They are probably the famous 24 best oak trees in the land, given to the priory by the king. Notice the ends." Carris could see that the huge posts had originally been sharpened into points, though their outlines had been softened by years under water. Merthyn said, "A timber bridge has no foundations. The posts are simply driven into the riverbed. That's not good enough."
"But this bridge has stood for hundreds of years," Edmund said indignantly.
He always sounded quarrelsome when he argued. Merthyn was used to him, and paid no attention to his tone of voice.
"And now it has fallen down," he said patiently. "Something has changed. Wooden piers were once firm enough, but no longer."
"What can have changed? The river is the river."
"Well, for one thing, you built a barn and a jetty on the bank, and protected the property with a wall. Several other merchants did the same. The old mud beach, where I used to play, on the south shore, has mostly gone, so the river can no longer spread itself into the fields. As a result, the water flows faster than it used to, especially after the kind of heavy rain we've had this year."
"So it will have to be a stone bridge?"
"Yes."
Edmund looked up and saw Elphick standing by, listening.
"Merthyn says a stone bridge will take 3 years.
Elphick nodded.
"Three building seasons?"
Most building was done in the warmer months, Carris knew. Merthyn had explained to her that stone walls could not be constructed when there was a risk that the mortar might freeze before it had begun to set. Elphick went on.
"One season for the foundations, one for the arches, and one for the roadbed. After each stage, the mortar must be left for 3 or 4 months to set hard before the next stage can be laid on top of it."
3 years with no bridge," Edmund said gloomily.
4 years, unless you get started right away."
"You'd better prepare an estimate of the cost for the priory."
"I've already started, but it's a long job. It will take me another 2 or 3 days."
"Quick as you can." Edmund and Carris left the riverside and walked up the main street, Edmund with his energetically lopsided stride. He would never lean on anyone's arm, despite his withered leg. To keep his balance, he swung his arms as if he were sprinting. The townspeople knew to give him plenty of room, especially when he was in a hurry.
3 years, he said as they walked. "It will do terrible damage to the fleece fair. I don't know how long it will take us to get back to normal. 3 years!
When they got home, they found Carris's sister Alice there. Her hair was tied up in her hat in an elaborate new style, copied from Lady Philippa.
She was sitting at the table with Aunt Petronilla. Caris knew immediately from the looks on their faces that they had been talking about her. Petronilla went to the kitchen and came back with ale, bread, and fresh butter. She filled a cup for Edmund. Petronilla had cried on Sunday, but since then she had shown little sign of bereavement for her dead brother, Antony. Surprisingly, Edmund, who had never liked Antony, seemed to grieve more. Tears would come to his eyes at unexpected moments during the day, though they would disappear just as quickly. Now he was full of news of the bridge. Alice was inclined to question Merthyn's judgment, but Edmund dismissed that notion impatiently.
"The boy's a genius," he said. "He knows more than many master builders, yet he isn't out of his apprenticeship."
Caris said bitterly, "All the more shame that he's going to spend his life with Griselda." Alice leaped to the defense of her stepdaughter. "There's nothing wrong with Griselda." "Yes, there is," Caris said. "She doesn't love him. She seduced him because her boyfriend left town, that's all." "Is that the story Merthyn's telling you?" Alice laughed sarcastically. "If a man doesn't want to do it, he doesn't do it. Take my word." Edmund grunted.
"Men can be tempted," he said.
"Oh, so you're siding with Caris, are you, Papa?" Alice said. "I shouldn't be surprised. You usually do."
"It's not a question of taking sides," Edmund replied. "A man may not want to do a thing beforehand, and he may regret it afterwards. Yet for a brief moment his wishes may change, especially when a woman uses her wiles."
"Wiles? Why do you assume that she threw herself at him?"
"I didn't say that. But I understand it began when she cried and he comforted her."
Caris herself had told him this. Alice made a disgusted sound. "You've always had a soft spot for that insubordinate apprentice." Caris ate some bread with butter, but she had no appetite. She said, "I suppose they'll have half a dozen fat children, and Merthyn will inherit Elfric's business and become just another town tradesman, building houses for merchants and fawning on clergymen for contracts, just like his father-in-law." Petronilla said, "And very lucky so to do. He'll be one of the leading men of the town. He's worthy of a better destiny."
"Is he really?"
Petronilla said in mock amazement.
"And him the son of a knight who fell from grace and hasn't a shilling to buy shoes for his wife. What exactly do you believe him to be destined for?"
Caris was stung by this mockery. It was true that Merthyn's parents were poor Corodians, dependent on the priory for their food and drink. For him to inherit a successful building business would indeed mean a jump up the social ladder. Yet she still felt he deserved better. She could not say exactly what future she had in mind for him. She just knew that he was different from everyone else in town, and she could not bear the thought of his becoming like the rest. On Friday, Caris took Gwenda to see Matty Wise. Gwenda was still in town because Wulfric was there, attending to the burial of his family. Elaine, Edmund's housemaid, had dried Gwenda's dress in front of the fire, and Caris had bandaged her feet and given her an old pair of shoes. Caris felt that Gwenda was not telling the full truth about her adventure in the forest. She said that Sim had taken her to the outlaws and she had escaped. He had chased after her, and he had died in the bridge collapse. John Constable was satisfied with that story. Outlaws were outside the law, as their name indicated, so there was no question of Sim bequeathing his property. Gwenda was free. But something else had happened in the forest, Caris felt sure, something Gwenda did not want to talk about. Caris did not press her friend. Some things were best buried. Funerals were the business of the town this week. The extraordinary manner of the deaths made little difference to the rituals of interment. The bodies had to be washed, the shroud sewn for the poor, the coffins nailed for the rich, the graves dug, and the priests paid. Not all the monks were qualified as priests, but several were, and they worked in shifts, all day, every day, conducting obsequies in the cemetery on the north side of the cathedral. There were half a dozen small parish churches in Kingsbridge, and their priests were also busy. Gwendo was helping Wulfric with the arrangements, performing the traditional woman's tasks, washing the bodies and making the shrouds, doing what she could to comfort him. He was in a kind of daze. He managed the details of the burial well enough, but spent hours gazing into space with a slightly puzzled frown, as if trying to make sense of a massive conundrum. By Friday the funerals were over, but the acting prior, Carlos, had announced a special service on Sunday for the souls of all those killed, so Wulfric was staying until Monday. Gwenda reported to Caris that he seemed grateful for the company of someone from his own village, but showed animation only when talking about Annette. Caris offered to buy her another love potion. They found Matty Wise in her kitchen, brewing medicines. The little house smelled of herbs, oil, and wine. "I used just about everything I had on Saturday and Sunday," she said. "I need to restock." "You must have made some money, anyway," Gwenda said. "Yes, if I can collect it." Caris was shocked. "Do people Welsh on you?" "Some do. I always try to collect the fee in advance, while they're still in pain. But if they haven't got the money there and then, it's hard to refuse them treatment. Most pay up afterwards, but not all." Caris felt indignant on behalf of her friend. "What do they say?" "All sorts of things. They can't afford it. The potion did them no good. They were given it against their will. Anything. But don't worry. There are enough honest people for me to continue. What's on your mind?" "Gwenda lost her love potion in the accident." "That's easily remedied. Why don't you prepare it for her?" While Caris was making up the mixture, she asked Matty, "How many pregnancies end in a miscarriage?" Gwenda knew why she was asking. Caris had told her all about Merthin's dilemma. The two girls had spent most of their time together discussing either Wulfric's indifference or Merthin's high principles. Caris had even been tempted to buy a love potion herself and use it on Merthin, though something held her back. Matty gave her a sharp look, but answered non-committally, "No one knows. Many times a woman misses 1 month, but comes on again the next. Did she get pregnant and lose the baby, or was there some other reason? It's impossible to tell."
"Oh."
"Neither of you is pregnant, though, if that's what you're worried about," Gwenda said quickly.
"How do you know?"
"By looking at you. A woman changes almost immediately. Not just her belly and her breasts, but her complexion, her way of moving, her mood. I see these things better than most people. That's why they call me wise. So, who is pregnant?"
"Griselda, Elfric's daughter."
"Oh, yes, I've seen her. She's 3 months gone." Caris was astonished. "How long?"
3 months, or very nearly. Take a look at her. She was never a thin girl, but she's even more voluptuous now."
"So why are you so shocked? I suppose it's Merthin's baby, is it?"
Matty always guessed these things.
Gwenda said to Caris, "I thought you told me it happened recently."
"Merthin didn't say exactly when, but he gave me the impression it was not long ago, and it only happened once. Now it seems he's been doing it to her for months."
Matty frowned.
"Why would he lie?"
"To make himself look not so bad," Gwenda suggested.
"How could it be worse? Men are peculiar the way they think."
"I'm going to ask him," Caris said. "Right now." She put down the jar and the measuring spoon.
Gwenda said, "What about my love potion?"
"I'll finish making it," Matty said. "Caris is in too much of a hurry."
"Thank you," Caris said, and she went out.
She marched down to the riverside, but for once Merthin was not there. She failed to find him at Elfric's house either. She decided he must be in the mason's loft. In the west front of the cathedral, neatly fitted into one of the towers, was a workroom for the master mason. Caris reached it by climbing a narrow spiral staircase in a buttress of the tower. It was a wide room, well lit by tall lancet windows. All along one wall were stacked the beautifully shaped wooden templates used by the original cathedral stone carvers, carefully preserved and used now for repairs. Underfoot was the tracing floor. The floorboards were covered with a layer of plaster, and the original master mason, Jack Builder, had scratched his plans in the mortar with iron drawing instruments. The marks thus made were white at first, but they faded over time, and new drawings could be scratched on top of the old. When there were so many designs that it became hard to tell the new from the old, a fresh layer of plaster was laid on top, and the process began again. Parchment, the thin leather on which monks copied out the books of the Bible, was much too expensive to be used for drawings. In Carus's lifetime, a new writing material had appeared, paper, but it came from the Arabs, so monks rejected it as a heathen Muslim invention. Anyway, it had to be imported from Italy and was no cheaper than parchment. And the tracing floor had another advantage. A carpenter could lay a piece of wood on the floor, on top of the drawing, and carve his template exactly to the lines drawn by the master mason. Merthin was kneeling on the floor, carving a piece of oak in accordance with a drawing, but he was not making a template. He was carving a cogwheel with 16 teeth. On the floor, close by, was another smaller wheel, and Merthin stopped carving for a moment to put the two together and see how well they fitted. Carus had seen such cogs, or gears, in watermills, connecting the mill paddle to the grindstone. He must have heard her footsteps on the stone staircase, but he was too absorbed in his work to glance up. She regarded him for a second, anger competing with love in her heart. He had the look of total concentration that she knew so well. His slight body bent over his work, his strong hands and dexterous fingers making fine adjustments, his face immobile, his gaze unwavering. He had the perfect grace of a young deer bending its head to drink from a stream. This was what a man looked like, she thought, when he was doing what he was born to do. He was in a state like happiness, but more profound. He was fulfilling his destiny. She burst out, "Why did you lie to me?" His chisel slipped. He cried out in pain and looked at his finger. "Christ!" he said, and put his finger in his mouth. "I'm sorry," Carus said. "Are you hurt?" "Nothing much. When did I lie to you? You gave me the impression that Griselda seduced you one time. The truth is that the two of you have been at it for months." "No, we haven't." He sucked his bleeding finger. "She's 3 months pregnant." "She can't be. It happened 2 weeks ago." "She is. You can tell by her figure." "Can you? Matty Wise told me. Why did you lie?" He looked her in the eye. "But I didn't lie," he said. "It happened on the Sunday of Fleece Fair week. That was the first and only time." "Then how could she be sure she's pregnant after only 2 weeks?" "I don't know. How soon can women tell, anyway?" "Don't you know? I've never asked. Anyway, 3 months ago, Griselda was still with..." "Oh, God," Carus said. A spark of hope flared in her breast. She was still with her old boyfriend, Thurston. The spark blazed into a flame. "It must be his baby, Thurston's, not yours. You're not the father." "Is it possible?" Merthin seemed hardly to dare to hope. "Of course. It explains everything. If she had suddenly fallen in love with you, she'd be after you every chance she gets. But you said she hardly speaks to you." "I thought that was because I was reluctant to marry her." "She's never liked you." "She just needed a father for her baby. Thurston ran away, probably when she told him she was pregnant. And you were right there in the house, and stupid enough to fall for her trick. Oh, thank God." "Thank Matty Wise," said Merthin. She caught sight of his left hand. Blood was welling from a finger. "Oh, I made you hurt yourself," she cried. She took his hand and examined the cut. It was small, but deep.
I'm so sorry.
It's not that bad.
But it is,
she said, not knowing whether she was talking about the cut or something else. She kissed his hand, feeling his hot blood on her lips. She put his finger in her mouth, sucking the wound clean. It was so intimate that it felt like a sexual act, and she closed her eyes, feeling ecstatic. She swallowed, tasting his blood, and shuddered with pleasure. A week after the bridge collapsed, Merthyn had built a ferry. It was ready at dawn on Saturday morning, in time for the weekly Kingsbridge market. He had worked on it by lamplight all Friday night, and Caris guessed he had not had time to speak to Griselda and tell her he knew the baby was Thurston's. Caris and her father came down to the riverside to see the new sensation as the first traders arrived, women from the surrounding villages with baskets of eggs, peasants with cartloads of butter and cheese, and shepherds with flocks of lambs. Caris admired Merthyn's work. The raft was large enough to carry a horse and cart without taking the beast out of the shafts, and it had a firm wooden railing to keep sheep from falling overboard. New wooden platforms at water level on both banks made it easy for carts to roll on and off. Passengers paid a penny, collected by a monk. The ferry, like the bridge, belonged to the priory. Most ingenious was the system Merthyn had devised for moving the raft from one bank to the other. A long rope ran from the south end of the raft, across the river, around a post, back across the river, around a drum, and back to the raft, where it was attached again at the north end. The drum was connected by wooden gears to a wheel turned by a pacing ox. Caris had seen Merthyn carving the gears yesterday. A lever altered the gears so that the drum turned in either direction, depending on whether the raft was going or coming back, and there was no need to take the ox out of its traces and turn it around. "It's quite simple," Merthyn said when she marveled at it, and it was when she looked closely. The lever simply lifted one large cogwheel up out of the chain and moved into its place two smaller wheels, the effect being to reverse the direction in which the drum turned. All the same, no one in Kingsbridge had seen anything like it. During the course of the morning, half the town came to look at Merthyn's amazing new machine. Caris was bursting with pride in him. Elfric stood by, explaining the mechanism to anyone who asked, taking the credit for Merthyn's work. Caris wondered where Elfric got the nerve. He had destroyed Merthyn's door, an act of violence that would have scandalized the town, had it not been overtaken by the greater tragedy of the bridge collapse. He had beaten Merthyn with a stick, and Merthyn still had the bruise on his face, and he had colluded in a deception intended to make Merthyn marry Griselda and raise another man's child. Merthyn had continued to work with him, feeling that the emergency outweighed their quarrel. But Caris did not know how Elfric could continue to hold his head up. The ferry was brilliant, but inadequate. Edmund pointed this out. On the far side of the river, carts and traders were queuing all along the road through the suburbs as far as the eye could see.
"It would go faster with two oxen," Merthyn said. "Twice as fast."
"Not quite, no.
I could build another ferry."
"There's already a second one," Edmund said, pointing. He was right. Ian Boatman was rowing foot passengers across. Ian could not take carts, he refused livestock, and he charged tuppence. Normally he had trouble scraping a living. He took a monk across to Leper Island twice a day and found little other business. But today he, too, had a queue. Merthyn said, "Well, you're right. In the end, a ferry is not a bridge."
"This is a catastrophe," Edmund said. "Buenaventura's news was bad enough, but this could kill the town."
"Then you must have a new bridge."
"It's not me, it's the priory. The prior is dead, and there's no telling how long they will take to elect a new one. We'll just have to pressure the acting prior to make a decision. I'll go and see Carlos now. Come with me, Caris."
They walked up the street and entered the priory. Most visitors had to go to the hospital, and tell one of the servants that they wanted to speak to a monk. But Edmund was too important a personage, and too proud, to beg the favour of an audience in that way. The prior was Lord of Kingsbridge, but Edmund was Alderman of the Guild, leader of the merchants who made the town what it was, and he treated the prior as a partner in the governance of the town. Besides, for the last 13 years the prior had been his younger brother, so he went straight to the prior's house on the north side of the cathedral. It was a timber-framed house like Edmund's, with a hall and a parlour on the ground floor and 2 bedrooms upstairs. There was no kitchen, for the prior's meals were prepared in the monastery kitchen. Many bishops and priors lived in palaces, and the Bishop of Kingsbridge had a fine place in Shiring, but the prior of Kingsbridge lived modestly. However, the chairs were comfortable, the wall was hung with tapestries of Bible scenes, and there was a big fireplace to keep the house cosy in winter. Caris and Edmund arrived mid-morning, the time when younger monks were supposed to labour, and their elders to read. Edmund and Caris found blind Carlos in the hall of the prior's house, deep in conversation with Simeon, the treasurer. "We must talk about the new bridge," Edmund said immediately. "Very well, Edmund," Carlos said, recognizing him by his voice. The welcome was not warm, Caris noted, and she wondered if they had come at a bad time. Edmund was just as sensitive as she to atmosphere, but he always blustered through. Now he took a chair and said, "When do you think you'll hold the election for the new prior?" "You can sit down too, Caris," said Carlos. She had no idea how he knew she was there. "No date has been set for the election," he went on. "Earl Rowland has the right to nominate a candidate, but he has not yet recovered consciousness." "We can't wait," Edmund said. Caris thought he was being too abrupt, but this was his way, so she said nothing. "We have to start work on the new bridge right away," her father continued. "Timber's no good. We have to build in stone. It's going to take 3 years, 4 if we delay." "A stone bridge?" "It's essential. I've been talking to Alfric and Merthin. Another wooden bridge would fall down like the old." "But the cost?" "About £250, depending on the design. That's Alfric's calculation." Brother Simeon said, "A new wooden bridge would cost £50, and Prior Anthony rejected that 2 weeks ago because of the price. And look at the result. 100 people dead, many more injured, livestock and carts lost, the Prior dead, and the Earl at death's door." Carlos said stiffly, "I hope you don't mean to blame all that on the late Prior Anthony." "We can't pretend his decision worked out well. God has punished us for sin." Edmund sighed. Caris felt frustrated. Whenever they were in the wrong, monks would bring God into the argument. Edmund said, "It is hard for us mere men to know God's intentions, but one thing we do know is that without a bridge, this town will die. We're already losing out to Shiring. Unless we build a new stone bridge as fast as we possibly can, Kingsbridge will soon become a small village." "That may be God's plan for us." Edmund began to show his exasperation. "Is it possible that God is so displeased with you monks? For believe me, if the feast fair and the Kingsbridge market die, there will not be a priory here with 25 monks and 40 nuns and 50 employees and a hospital and a choir and a school. There may not be a cathedral either. The Bishop of Kingsbridge has always lived in Shiring. What if the prosperous merchants there offer to build him a splendid new cathedral in their own town, out of the profits from their ever-growing market? No Kingsbridge market, no town, no cathedral, no priory. Is that what you want?" Carlos looked dismayed. Clearly it had not occurred to him that the long-term consequences of the bridge collapse could actually affect the status of the priory. But Simeon said, "If the priory can't afford to build a wooden bridge, there's certainly no prospect of a stone one.
But you must.
Will the masons work free?
Certainly not. They have to feed their families. But we've already explained how the townspeople could raise the money and lend it to the priory against the security of the bridge tolls.
And take away our income from the bridge?
Simeon said indignantly.
You're back to that swindle, are you?
Caris put in, You've got no bridge tolls at all now.
On the contrary, we're collecting fares on the ferry.
You found the money to pay Alfric for that, a lot less than a bridge, and even so it emptied our coffers. The fares will never amount to much. The ferry is too slow.
The time may come, in the future, when the priory is able to build a new bridge. God will send the means if he wishes it, and then we will still have the tolls.
Edmund said, God has already sent the means. He inspired my daughter to dream up a way of raising the money that has never been thought of before. Carlos said primly, Please leave it to us to decide what God has done.
Very well.
Edmund stood up, and Caris did the same. I'm very sorry you're taking this attitude.
It's a catastrophe for Kingsbridge and everyone who lives here, including the monks.
I must be guided by God, not you. Edmund and Caris turned to leave.
One more thing, if I may,
said Carlos. Edmund turned at the door.
Of course.
It's not acceptable for lay people to enter priory buildings at will. Next time you wish to see me, please come to the hospital and send a novice or a priory servant to seek me out, in the usual way.
I'm alderman of the parish guild, Edmund protested. I've always had direct access to the prior.
No doubt the fact that Prior Anthony was your brother made him reluctant to impose the usual rules. But those days are over. Caris looked at her father's face. He was repressing fury.
Very well, he said tightly.
God bless you. Edmund went out, and Caris followed. They walked across the muddy green together, passing a pitifully small cluster of market stalls. Caris felt the weight of her father's obligations. Most people just worried about feeding their families. Edmund worried about the entire town. She glanced at him and saw that his expression was twisted into an anxious frown. Unlike Carlos, Edmund would not throw his hands in the air and say that God's will would be done. He was racking his brains for a solution to the problem. She felt a surge of compassion for him, straining to do the right thing with no help from the powerful priory. He never complained of the responsibility. He just took it on. It made her want to weep. They left the precincts and crossed the main street. As they came to their front door, Caris said, What are we going to do?
It's obvious, isn't it? Said her father. We've got to make sure Carlos doesn't get elected prior.
Chapter 15 Godwin wanted to be prior of Kingsbridge. He longed for it with all his heart. He itched to reform the priory's finances, tightening up the management of its lands and other assets, so that the monks no longer had to go to Mother Cecilia for money. He yearned for the stricter separation of monks from nuns, and both from townspeople, so that they might all breathe the pure air of sanctity. But as well as these irreproachable motives, there was something else. He lusted for the authority and distinction of the title. At night, in his imagination, he was already prior.
Clean up that mess in the cloister, he would say to a monk.
Yes, Father Prior, right away. Godwin loved the sound of Father Prior. Good day, Bishop Richard, he would say, not obsequiously, but with friendly courtesy. And Bishop Richard would reply, as one distinguished clergyman to another, and a good day to you too, Prior Godwin.
I trust everything is to your satisfaction, Archbishop, he might say, more deferentially this time, but still as a junior colleague of the great man, rather than as an underling.
Oh, yes, Godwin, you've done extraordinarily well here.
Your reverence is very kind.
And perhaps, one day, strolling in the cloister side by side with a richly dressed potentate, Your Majesty does us great honour to visit our humble priory. Thank you, Father Godwin, but I come to ask your advice. He wanted this position, but he was not sure how to get it. He pondered the question all week, as he supervised 100 burials, and planned the big Sunday service that would be both Antony's funeral and a remembrance for the souls of all the Kingsbridge dead. Meanwhile, he spoke to no one of his hopes. It was only 10 days ago that he had learned the price of being guileless. He had gone to the chapter with Timothy's book and a strong argument for reform, and the old guard had turned on him with perfect coordination, as if they had rehearsed it, and squashed him like a frog under a cartwheel. He would not let that happen again. On Sunday morning, as the monks were filing into the refectory for breakfast, a novice whispered to Godwin that his mother would like to see him in the north porch of the cathedral. He slipped away discreetly. He felt apprehensive as he passed quietly through the cloisters and the church. He could guess what had happened. Something had occurred yesterday to trouble Petronilla. She had lain awake half the night, worrying about it. This morning she had woken up at dawn with a plan of action, and he was part of it. She would be at her most impatient and domineering. Her plan would probably be good, but even if it was not, she would insist he carry it out. She stood in the gloom of the porch in a wet cloak. It was raining again. "My brother Edmund came to see blind Carlos yesterday," she said. "He tells me that Carlos is acting as if he is already prior, and the election is a mere formality." There was an accusing note in her voice, as if this was Godwin's fault, and he answered defensively. "The old guard swung behind Carlos before Uncle Antony's body was cold. They won't hear talk of rival candidates." "Hmm. And the youngsters?" "They want me to run, of course. They liked the way I stood up to Prior Antony over Timothy's book, even though I was overruled. But I've said nothing." "Any other candidates?" "Thomas Langley is the outsider. Some disapprove of him because he used to be a knight and has killed people, by his own admission. But he's capable, does his job with quiet efficiency, never bullies the novices." His mother looked thoughtful. "What's his story? Why did he become a monk?" Godwin's apprehension began to ease. It seemed she was not going to berate him for inaction. "Thomas just says he always hankered for the sanctified life, and, when he came here to get a sword wound attended to, he resolved never to leave." "I remember that. It was 10 years ago. But I never did hear how he got the wound." "Nor I. He doesn't like to talk about his violent past." "Who paid for his admission to the priory?" "Oddly enough, I don't know." Godwin often marvelled at his mother's ability to ask the revealing question. She might be tyrannical, but he had to admire her. "It might have been Bishop Richard. I recall him promising the usual gift. But he wouldn't have had the resources personally. He wasn't a bishop then, just a priest. Perhaps he was speaking for Earl Rowland." "Find out." Godwin hesitated. He would have to look through all the charters in the priory's library. The librarian, Brother Augustine, would not presume to question the sacrist, but someone else might. Then Godwin would have the awkwardness of inventing a plausible story to explain what he was doing. If the gift had been cash rather than land or other property, unusual but possible, he would have to go through the account rolls. "What's the matter?" his mother said sharply. "Nothing. You're right." He reminded himself that her domineering attitude was a sign of her love for him, perhaps the only way she knew how to express it. There must be a record. "Come to think of it."
"What?"
"A gift like that is usually trumpeted. The priory announces it in church, and calls down blessings on the head of the donor, then preaches a sermon on how people who give lands to the priory are rewarded in heaven. But I don't remember anything like that happening at the time Thomas came to us."
All the more reason to seek out the charter. I think Thomas is a man with a secret, and a secret is always a weakness. I'll look into it. What do you think I should say to people who want me to stand for election?
Petronilla smiled slyly. I think you should tell them you're not going to be a candidate.
Breakfast was over by the time Godwin left his mother. Latecomers were not allowed to eat by a long-standing rule, but the kitchener, Brother Reynard, could always find a morsel for someone he liked. Godwin went to the kitchen and got a slice of cheese and a heel of bread. He ate it standing up, while around him the priory servants brought the breakfast bowls back from the refectory and scrubbed out the iron pot in which the porridge had been cooked. As he ate, he mulled over his mother's advice. The more he thought about it, the cleverer it seemed. Once he had announced he would not stand for election, everything else, he said, would carry the authority of a disinterested commentator. He could manipulate the election without being suspected of selfish motives. Then he could make his move at the last moment. He felt a warm glow of loving gratitude for the shrewdness of his mother's restless brain and the loyalty of her indomitable heart. Brother Theodoric found him there. Theodoric's fair complexion was flushed with indignation. "Brother Simeon spoke to us at breakfast about Carlos becoming prior," he said. "It was all about continuing the wise traditions of Antony. He's not going to change anything." That was sly, Godwin thought. Simeon had taken advantage of Godwin's absence to say, with authority, things that Godwin would have challenged if he had been present. He said sympathetically, "That's disgraceful. I asked whether the other candidates would be permitted to address the monks at breakfast in the same way." Godwin grinned. "Good for you. Simeon said there was no need for other candidates. We're not holding an archery contest," he said. "In his view, the decision has already been made. Prior Antony chose Carlos as his successor by making him sub-prior."
"That's complete rubbish."
"Exactly. The monks are furious."
This was very good, Godwin thought. Carlos had offended even his supporters by trying to take away their right to vote. He was undermining his own candidacy.
Theodoric went on, "I think we should press Carlos to withdraw himself from the contest."
Godwin wanted to say, "Are you mad?" He bit his tongue and tried to look as if he were mulling over what Theodoric had said.
"Is that the best way to deal with it?" he asked, as if genuinely unsure. Theodoric was surprised by the question. "What do you mean? You say the brothers are all furious with Carlos and Simeon. If this goes on, they won't vote for Carlos. But if Carlos withdraws, the old guard will come up with another candidate. They could make a better choice the second time. It might be someone popular. Brother Joseph, for example."
Theodoric was thunderstruck.
"I never thought of it that way."
"Perhaps we should hope that Carlos remains the choice of the old guard. Everyone knows he's against any kind of change. The reason he's a monk is that he likes to know that every day will be the same. He'll walk the same paths, sit in the same seats, eat and pray and sleep in the same places. Perhaps it's because of his blindness, though I suspect he might have been like that anyway. The cause doesn't matter. He believes that nothing here needs changing. Now, there aren't many monks who are that contented, which makes Carlos relatively easy to beat. A candidate who represented the old guard but advocated a few minor reforms would be much more likely to win."
Godwin realized he had forgotten to seem tentative and had started laying down the law. Backtracking quickly, he added, "I don't know. What do you think?"
"I think you're a genius," said Theodoric.
"I'm not a genius," Godwin thought, "but I learn fast." He went to the hospital, where he found Philemon sweeping out the private guest rooms upstairs. Lord William was still here, watching over his father, waiting for him to wake up or die. Lady Philippa was with him. Bishop Richard had returned to his palace in Shiring, but was expected back today for the big funeral service. Godwin took Philemon to the library. Philemon could barely read, but he would be useful for getting out the charters. The priory had more than 100 charters. Most were deeds to landholdings, the majority near Kingsbridge, some scattered around far parts of England and Wales. Other charters entitled the monks to establish their priory, to build a church, to take stone from a quarry on the Earl of Shiring's land without payment, to parcel the land around the priory into house plots and rent them out, to hold courts, to have a weekly market, to charge a toll for crossing the bridge, to have an annual fleece fair, and to ship goods by river to Malcolm without paying taxes to the lords of any of the lands through which the river passed. The documents were written with pen and ink on parchment, thin leather painstakingly cleaned and scraped and bleached and stretched to form a writing surface. Longer ones were rolled up and tied with a fine leather thong. They were kept in an iron-bound chest. The chest was locked, but the key was in the library, in a small carved box. Godwin frowned with disapproval when he opened the chest. The charters were not lined up in neat stacks, but tumbled in the box in no apparent order. Some had small rips and frayed edges, and all were covered with dust. They should be kept in date sequence, he thought, each one numbered, and the numbered list fixed to the inside of the lid, so that any particular charter could be quickly located. If I become prior... Philemon took the charters out, one by one, blew off the dust, and laid them on a table for Godwin. Most people disliked Philemon. One or two of the older monks mistrusted him, but Godwin did not. It was hard to mistrust someone who treated you like a god. Most of the monks were just used to him. He had been around for so long. Godwin remembered him as a boy, tall and awkward, always hanging around the priory, asking the monks which saint was best to pray to, and had they ever witnessed a miracle. Most of the charters had originally been written out twice on a single sheet. The word chirograph had been written in large letters between the two copies. Then the sheet had been cut in half with a zigzag line through the word. Each of the parties kept half the sheet, and the match between the zigzags was taken as proof that both documents were genuine. Some of the sheets had holes, probably where the living sheep had been bitten by an insect. Others appeared to have been nibbled at some point in their history, presumably by mice. They were written in Latin, of course. The more recent ones were easier to read, but the older style of handwriting was sometimes hard for Godwin to decipher. He scanned each until he came to a date. He was looking for something written soon after All Hallows Day, 10 years ago. He examined every sheet and found nothing. The nearest was a deed dated some weeks later, in which Earl Rowland gave permission to Sir Gerald to transfer his lands to the ownership of the priory, in exchange for which the priory would forgive Gerald's debts and support him and his wife for the rest of their lives. Godwin was not really disappointed. Rather the contrary. Either Thomas had been admitted without the usual gift, which would in itself be curious, or the charter was kept somewhere else, away from prying eyes. Either way, it seemed increasingly likely that Petronilla's instinct was right, and Thomas had a secret. There were not many private places in a monastery. Monks were supposed to have no personal property and no secrets. Although some wealthy monasteries had built private cells for the senior monks, at Kingsbridge they slept in one big room, all except the prior himself. Almost certainly the charter that had secured Thomas's admission was in the prior's house, which was now occupied by Carlos. That made things difficult. Carlos would not let Godwin search the place. Searching might hardly be necessary. There was probably a box or satchel somewhere in plain sight containing the late Prior Anthony's personal documents, a notebook from his novice days, a friendly letter from the Archbishop, some sermons. Carlos had probably examined the contents after Anthony died, but he had no reason to permit Godwin to do the same. Godwin frowned, thinking. Could someone else search? Edmund or Petronilla might ask to see their late brother's possessions, and it would be hard for Carlos to deny such a request. But he might remove any priory documents beforehand, No, the search had to be clandestine. The bell rang for Terse, the morning office. Godwin realized that the only time he could be certain Carlos would not be in the prior's house was during a service in the cathedral. He would have to skip Terse. He could think up a plausible excuse. It would not be easy. He was the sacrist, the one person who should never skip services, but there was no alternative. "I want you to come to me in the church," he said to Philemon. "All right," said Philemon, though he looked worried. Priory employees were not supposed to enter the chancel during worship. "Come right after the verse. Whisper in my ear. It doesn't matter what you say. Take no notice of my reaction. Just continue." Philemon frowned anxiously, but he nodded assent. He would do anything for Godwin. Godwin left the library and joined the procession into the church. There was only a handful of people standing in the nave. Most of the town would come later in the day to attend the mass for the victims of the bridge collapse. The monks took their places in the chancel, and the ritual began. "O God, incline unto mine aid," Godwin said, along with the rest. They finished the verse and began the first hymn, and Philemon appeared. All the monks stared at him, as people always did stare at anything out of the ordinary that occurred during a familiar rite. Brother Simeon frowned disapprovingly. Carlos, conducting the singing, sensed a disturbance and looked puzzled. Philemon came to Godwin's seat and bent over. "Blessed is the man that walketh not in the counsel of the ungodly," he whispered. Godwin pretended to be surprised, and continued to listen while Philemon recited Psalm number 1. After a few moments he shook his head vigorously, as if denying a request. Then he listened some more. He was going to have to think up an elaborate story to account for this pantomime. Perhaps he would say that his mother had insisted on speaking to him immediately about the funeral of her brother, Prior Antony, and that she was threatening to come into the chancel herself unless Philemon took a message to Godwin. Petronilla's overbearing personality, combined with family grief, made the story just about credible. As Philemon finished the psalm, Godwin made a resigned face and got up and followed Philemon out of the chancel. They hurried around the cathedral to the prior's house. A young employee was sweeping the floor. He would not dare to question a monk. He might tell Carlos that Godwin and Philemon had been here, but it would be too late then. Godwin thought the prior's house was a disgrace. It was smaller than Uncle Edmund's home in the main street. A prior should have a palace befitting his station, as the bishop did. There was nothing glorious about this building. A few tapestries covered the walls, depicting biblical scenes and keeping out the drafts. But overall the decor was dull and unimaginative, rather like the late Antony. They searched the place quickly, and soon found what they were looking for. Upstairs in the bedroom, in a chest beside the prie-dieu, was a large wallet. It was made of soft ginger-brown goatskin and beautifully sewn with scarlet thread. Godwin felt sure it had been a pious gift from one of the town's leather workers. Watched intently by Philemon, he opened it. Inside were about 30 sheets of parchment, laid flat and interleaved with protective linen cloths. Godwin examined them quickly. Several bore study notes on the Psalms. Antony must at some time have contemplated writing a book of commentaries, but the work appeared to have been abandoned. The most surprising was a love poem in Latin, headed Virent Oculi. It was addressed to a man with green eyes. Uncle Antony had green eyes, flecked with gold, like all his family. Godwin wondered who had written it. Not many women could write Latin well enough to compose a poem. Had a nun loved Antony? Or was the poem from a man? The parchment was old and yellowing. The love affair, if such it was, had happened in Antony's youth. But he had kept the poem. Perhaps he had not been quite as dull as Godwin had imagined. Philemon said, "What is it?" Godwin felt guilty. He had peeped into a deeply private corner of his uncle's life, and he wished he had not. "Nothing," he said, Just a poem. He picked up the next sheet and struck gold. It was a charter dated Christmas, 10 years ago. It concerned a landholding of 500 acres near Lynn in Norfolk. The lord had recently died. The deed assigned the vacant lordship to Kingsbridge Priory and specified the annual dues, grain, fleeces, calves, and chickens, payable to the priory by the serfs and tenants who farmed the land. It nominated one of the peasants to be a bailiff, with the responsibility of delivering the produce to the priory annually. It also assigned money payments that could be offered instead of the actual produce, a practice that was now predominant, especially where the land was many miles from the residence of the lord. It was a typical charter. Every year after the harvest, representatives of dozens of similar communities made the pilgrimage to the priory to deliver what they owed. Those from nearby showed up early in the autumn. Others came at intervals through the winter, with a few from long distances not arriving until after Christmas. The deed also specified that the gift was given in consideration of the priory's accepting Sir Thomas Langley as a monk. That, too, was routine. But one feature of this document was not commonplace. It was signed by Queen Isabella. That was interesting. Isabella was the unfaithful wife of King Edward II. She had rebelled against her royal husband and installed, in his place, their 14-year-old son. Shortly afterwards, the deposed king had died, and Prior Anthony had been present at his burial in Gloucester. Thomas had come to Kingsbridge at around the same time. For a few years, the queen and her lover, Roger Mortimer, had ruled England. But before long, Edward III had asserted his authority, despite his youth. The new king was now 24 and firmly in control. Mortimer was dead, and Isabella, now 42, lived in opulent retirement at Castle Rising in Norfolk, not far from Lynn. "This is it," Godwin said to Philemon. "It was Queen Isabella who arranged for Thomas to become a monk." Philemon frowned. "But why?" Though uneducated, Philemon was shrewd. "Why, indeed," Godwin answered. "Presumably she wanted to reward him, or silence him, or perhaps both. And this happened in the year of her coup. He must have performed some service for her." Godwin nodded. "He carried a message, or opened the gates of a castle, or betrayed the king's plans to her, or secured for her the support of some important baron. But why is it a secret?" "It's not," said Philemon. "The treasurer must know about it, and everyone in Lynn. The bailiff must talk to a few people when he comes here. But no one knows that the whole arrangement was made for the benefit of Thomas, unless they have seen this charter. So that's the secret, that Queen Isabella made this gift for Thomas's sake." "Exactly." Godwin packed up the documents, carefully interleaving the sheets of parchment with linen cloths, and replaced the wallet in the chest. Philemon asked, "But why is it a secret? There's nothing dishonest or shameful about such an arrangement. It happens all the time." "I don't know why it's a secret, and perhaps we don't need to know. The fact that people want to keep it hidden may be sufficient for our purpose. Let's get out of this house." Godwin felt satisfied. Thomas had a secret, and Godwin knew about it. That gave Godwin power. Now he felt confident enough to risk putting Thomas forward as a candidate for prior. He also felt apprehensive. Thomas was no fool. They returned to the cathedral. The office of Terse ended a few moments later, and Godwin began to prepare the church for the big funeral service. On his instructions, 6 monks lifted Antony's coffin and placed it on a stand in front of the altar, then surrounded it with candles. Townspeople began to gather in the nave. Godwin nodded to his cousin Caris, who had covered her everyday headgear in black silk. Then he spotted Thomas, carrying in a large ornate chair with the help of a novice. This was the bishop's throne, or cathedra, that gave the church its special cathedral status. Godwin touched Thomas's arm. Let Philemon do that. Thomas bristled, thinking that Godwin was offering help because of his missing arm. I can manage.
I know you can. I want a word.
Thomas was older. He was 34, Godwin 31. But Godwin was his superior in the monastic hierarchy. All the same, Godwin was always a little afraid of Thomas. The matricularius usually showed the appropriate deference to the sacrist, but all the same Godwin felt he was getting just as much respect as Thomas thought he merited, and no more. Though Thomas conformed in every way to the discipline of St. Benedict's rule, nevertheless he seemed to have brought into the priory with him a quality of independence and self-sufficiency that he never lost. It would not be easy to deceive Thomas, but that was exactly what Godwin planned to do. Thomas allowed Philemon to take his side of the throne, and Godwin drew him into the aisle.
"They're talking about you as possibly the next prior,"
Godwin said. "They're saying the same about you," Thomas rejoined.
"I shall refuse to stand."
Thomas raised his eyebrows.
"You surprise me, brother."
"Two reasons," Godwin said. "One, I think you would do a better job." Thomas looked more surprised. He probably had not suspected Godwin of such modesty. He was right. Godwin was lying.
"Two," Godwin continued, "you're more likely to win."
Now Godwin was telling the truth.
"The youngsters like me, but you're popular across the range of all ages."
Thomas's handsome face looked quizzical. He was waiting for the catch.
"I want to help you," Godwin said. "I believe the only important thing is to have a prior who will reform the monastery and improve its finances."
"I think I could do that. But what do you want in return for your support?"
Godwin knew better than to ask for nothing. Thomas would not believe that. He invented a plausible lie.
"I'd like to be your sub-prior."
Thomas nodded, but did not immediately consent.
"How would you help me?"
"First, by gaining you the support of the townspeople."
"Just because Edmund Wooler is your uncle?"
"It's not that simple. The townspeople are worried about the bridge. Carlos won't say when he'll begin building, if ever. They're desperate to stop him becoming prior. If I tell Edmund that you'll start work on the bridge as soon as you're elected, you'll have the whole town behind you."
"That won't win me the votes of many monks."
"Don't be so sure. Remember, the monk's choice has to be ratified by the bishop. Most bishops are prudent enough to consult local opinion, and Richard is as keen as anyone to avoid trouble. If the townspeople come out for you, it will make a difference."
Godwin could see that Thomas did not trust him. The matricularius studied him, and Godwin felt a bead of sweat trickle down his spine as he fought to remain expressionless under that keen gaze. But Thomas was listening to his arguments.
"There's no doubt we need a new bridge," he said. "Carlos is foolish to prevaricate."
"So you would be promising something you intend to do anyway."
"You're very persuasive."
Godwin held up his hands in a defensive gesture.
"I don't mean to be.
You must do what you feel is God's will." Thomas looked skeptical. He did not believe that Godwin was so dispassionate. But he said,
"All right."
Then he added, "I'll pray about it." Godwin sensed he would get no stronger commitment out of Thomas today, and it might be counterproductive to push any harder.
"So will I," he said, and he turned away.
Thomas would do exactly what he had promised, and pray about it. He had little in the way of personal desires. If he thought it was God's will, he would stand as prior, and, if not, not. Godwin could do no more with him for the moment. There was now a blaze of candles around Antony's coffin. The nave was filling with townspeople and peasants from the surrounding villages. Godwin raked the crowd for the face of Caris, which he had spotted a few minutes earlier. He located her in the south transept, looking at Merthin's scaffolding in the aisle. He had affectionate memories of Caris as a child, when he had been her all-knowing grown-up cousin. She had been looking glum since the bridge collapse, he had noticed, but today she seemed cheerful. He was glad. He had a soft spot for her. He touched her elbow.
"You look happy."
"I am." She smiled. A romantic knot just came untangled. "But you wouldn't understand."
"Of course not."
"You have no idea," he thought, "how many romantic tangles there are among monks." But he said nothing. Lay people were best left in ignorance of sins that took place in the priory. He said, "Your father should speak to Bishop Richard about rebuilding the bridge."
"Really?"
she said skeptically. As a child she had hero-worshipped him, but nowadays she was less in awe. "What's the point?"